we were seeing what we began last week was the principle that the Rambam mentions and explains here. He just mentions it, that a person has to believe that there's a thing called prophecy, nevuah. That we are going through, for those who's new, who's never been here before. We are studying a section of the Rambam's classical encyclopedic summary of Torah laws. This section deals with the 13 categories of spiritual activity or inactivity that are so severe that they can lead to a person cutting himself off from the next world. Now that's what we're discussing. As we explained before, there are many things that a person can do that are negative. They damage a person spiritually, they damage the whole cosmic structure, damage relationships. But these 13 things are seminal in that they are a direct connection between a person and the next world. In other words, they're the 13 elements that build the oneness of a person's neshama. We said much more about that in the past. That's just a basic idea. Elsewhere, the Rambam lists these 13 things as 13 fundamentals of faith. Now, he says that these are the 13 things you have to believe to have a share in the next world. He says, rather, let's put it this way. We have a famous exposition of these 13, which is Ani Ma'amin Ben Munah Shleimah. I believe with a perfect faith the 13 things: the coming of the Mashiach, the fact that there is a resurrection, the fact that Hashem exists, that's the first one, that He's one, and so forth and so on. There he simply states them as elements of creed or belief. Here he states the negative, which is in halacha, right? That is, that if you don't believe these, or rather, if you know what you're talking about and deny them, not just someone who doesn't know, if you know what you mean and deny them, then you deny your own share in the world to come. Right? If you deny that there is such a thing as the world to come, then you don't have a share there. Because as we explained before, your existence in the next world, which is now, it's not then, it's now, is what you built, as we've tried to explain before. So these are 13 things that are critically important. Now, we started seeing together some of them, and what we began to study last week was the idea of prophecy. I'll read you the words and we'll try and explain it again. Try and see it in more depth. The Rambam says this. First of all, he said that there are five subcategories of people who are called minim, again, however you translate that, atheists or some form of atheism. And then he says there are three categories of people who are called apikosim. This is the second subcategory, and the subcategory is of three. And these people are called apikosim. Again, I don't know the English word for this. Again, some kind of deniers or heretics, something like that. And they are as follows. First of all, somebody who says that there's no such thing as prophecy. That means, v'ein sham moda, there is no such thing as a wisdom, that there's no such thing as a transcendent wisdom that reaches from the mystical world, or the transcendent world that reaches from the creator of the universe to the heart of a human being. Now, to understand this, we have to look a little bit into what is prophecy. Hold the questions for a while, if you don't mind. Just a few minutes. Let me just try and give you an overview of what we're talking about, and one or two unbelievable, amazing ideas about the difference between the generations of the world's history that experienced this thing and our generations. And if you have questions from then on in, you are welcome to ask if I'm able to answer. So we have to understand the following thing. First of all, what we mean by prophecy is not, again, the trouble here is that just about, perhaps more than any other area, we have to get out of the non-Jewish misconceptions. We're not talking about a man walking through the streets, you know, in sackcloth with a sign predicting the end of the world, you know. We're not talking about that. The idea that there may be some element of strangeness, that means that a prophet may be somebody who's a little eccentric, let's say. There is a root in that idea, and we tried to explain last week, is that the Gemara says that there are only three places that prophecy remains in the world in our generation, and that is in children, if we get time to discuss it, we can look at that in more detail. Dogs, it says, specifically. Animals in general, but dogs specifically. And people who are not sane, is what it says. So there is such an idea that people who aren't sane, although it may be very hard to access the prophetic element that they have, right, and we can't separate it out, usually when we need to, from that which is not prophetic, but nevertheless they have a sensitivity in that area. That's what it says. So that may be where the idea came from. But prophecy wasn't like that. The Gemara says clearly that for a man to be a prophet, he had to have many, many outstanding characteristics. He had to be, apart from being a great man spiritually, he had to be rich. He had to be physically of stature, a special build. There are many things that he needed that were the requirements for prophecy. Wealthy as well, that was one of them. Needed outstanding, he had an outstanding human being in many, many ways before he could even be a vessel for prophecy. And what it was a being in tune, an intuition, let's say, or being in tune with a certain element of reality that comes from the core of reality. But the experience was so real, this is what we can't understand, the Rambam explains it elsewhere, what we'll never be able to understand is that, well, we'll try a little bit tonight to maybe feel out some of it, but the Rambam explains elsewhere that the prophetic experience was so intense that when you heard a prophet speak, you actually experienced what he was saying. It wasn't that a person came along and told you certain predictions. That's not what prophecy was. It was an experience where when he spoke, he was so, he became a channel, he became, let's say, a glow. The prophet became electrified with his experience, but it was so obvious that it communicated itself to you. That means it was not that you could choose to believe or not believe. You weren't listening, in other words, to a human being saying something. You were actually witnessing the opening of a channel that came from another world. And that's why no one ever had a question about whether the prophecy was true or not, until the very, very end of the generation of prophecy, where for the first time a prophet was insulted. There was a prophet who was struck, people hit him, and after that Hashem said that's that, we don't deserve prophecy anymore, and the era of prophecy was closed. And we'll try and understand exactly what the final event was and how that happened. But until then, until that watershed borderline area, prophecy was an experience that was an electrifying experience. In fact, the Mefarshim say that the experience was so intense that it wasn't only that when you saw a prophet speaking, you experienced the knowledge, but the whole world looked different as long as there were prophets in the world. In other words, the whole world was, let's say, electrified or switched on. That means anything you saw in the world had the glow of Nevuah. So I first understand, the word Nevuah itself means, in Hebrew, Niv, the root Niv, means that which grows like from under the ground, like Tenuva in Hebrew. Tenuva means produce, that which sort of sprouts up, let's say, wells up from the ground. Right? Niv, the word Noveah in Hebrew, means to well up like a hidden spring. It means something that came from a hidden world into the world, but the whole world was aglow, incandescent, with that spiritual wisdom, knowledge. So it's a completely different idea. It's not, you see, our trouble is that we put everything into the frame of reference that's as small as we are. So we think everybody else, we judge people and the past and history and the Jewish people, we think that they had our problems, that they were shrunken down, shriveled, not in stature as we are in human terms. We're not like that at all. We're enormous, the giants, gigantic generations. Because we'll try and understand a bit more. That was, some, if you can begin to sort of use those words, then that's what it meant. You realize, of course, and this is going to be the hard thing to understand, you realize that if the world looked that way, you couldn't make mistakes. You couldn't make the kind of mistakes you can make today. If the world was a glow with its spiritual meaning, well, you weren't free to do anything wrong. If you witnessed, if you want to put it into our terms, it's like witnessing constant miracles. The idea of prophecy was connected with the manifestation of miracles. It says that for the whole generation, while prophecy was around, for all those generations, there were 10 constant miracles that happened in Yerushalayim. If you went to visit the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, you saw 10 constant miracles, amazing things that happened all the time. They were free, anybody could see them all the time. In other words, you actually saw the spiritual world. So now you're going to ask, you know, how did they make mistakes? Let's face it, the reason we make mistakes is because the spiritual world is not apparent to us. If you, this will be left to study in detail, we're going to take a trip into the inner workings of the Neshama. You'll see it's a most fantastic area to understand. And sure, as we began this discussion a little bit, trying to trace how prophecy gradually closed down, how the whole world was alight with it when the world was created, and gradually it was only Abraham Avinu, Abraham, who had that last little flicker of what's called Lashon Kodesh, and he passed it on to his children, and it lasted until the destruction of the Second Temple, or around the time of the Second Temple, maybe a little just after that, or just around that time, and then it died out. We try to trace its history. But the thing that we have to understand, let's try and focus on one element of it this evening, but now, this is going to take some doing, okay? You're going to have to stay with me now, because what we're going to do together is travel inwards into the Neshama, okay? But the words I'm going to say are going to be meaningless unless you can place them in your own emotions. The words are, you'll see the words are a story that may be nice, it might fit together, but take it or leave it. But if you trace it in terms of how your own emotions work, how your own Neshama, your own inner being works, you'll know instantaneously that this is the way it was. This is the way it is. So it's not easy to put it across. So let's try, let's do our best. Save the question just for a few minutes, okay? Try and get the picture first. So let's start like this. The hard thing to understand is this. If you had prophecy around, and it's the way I'm telling you, which is not just that somebody had information that was privileged, but that the whole world shone and you could actually see the experience, so then how could you do anything wrong? How could the people of those generations, and they did terrible things wrong, they did things wrong in those generations that were much more of enormity compared to what we do wrong today, spiritually. Right? How did they do things wrong if the truth was apparent to them? If you think about it, you'll realize the reason we do things wrong is simply because we live in doubt. Right? The reason you're able to insult someone or say something careless in a relationship that hurts somebody else is because you don't actually feel the pain. The spiritual world is closed to you. So when you say that thing and you think that you're winning a point with them in the argument or in the relationship, or you manage to be a little vindictive or whatever it is that you're busy doing, right? Or you just feel like doing it, or your lower self gets the better of you. Why do you allow yourself to do those things? Because the spiritual world is closed to you. You don't feel the pain. You don't realize what the person's going through. You've got your own vested interest, and that's all you see. But in a world that was alive with prophecy, you actually experienced the reality. You actually felt immediately what you were doing. The consequence, the effect, the cause and the effect were very, very close together in the world. There's an amazing statement in the Navi that says this. I think it's in Hosea, if I'm not mistaken. It says this, that when the end of the world comes, that means when the messianic redemption, messianic revelation occurs, there's an incredible statement in the Navi that says this, V'hayisi eid memaher, I will become a rushing witness. That's what it says. That when the Mashiach arrives, and we experience the reality of the world, right, I will become a rushing witness. That means suddenly consciousness will be opened up. I'll give you an example. It says, V'bochsa ha'aretz mishpachas mishpachas. Amazing thing. When the Mashiach arrives, the Navi says that the world will cry in families. That's what it says. Families will get together and cry. Families will get together and they will cry. So Mefoshim asked, but when the Mashiach comes, it's supposed to be happy. Why will people start crying when the Mashiach comes? So, again, you have to feel this out with the neshama. There's no way I can put it across to you in words. You have to feel it out. But there are amazing, amazing facets to this. One facet is, they say, it will be the crying that you experience when you see someone you haven't seen for many years. Somebody you've been longing to see for many years, and you haven't been able to see them. And what happens is, you get back together with that person. What happens is, you cry, which is crazy, because actually it's a very, very happy moment. Right? But actually the natural response is, the emotions work in such a way, it's a crazy thing. See, the neshama can tell you what this means. You can know what it means. If you don't have a neshama, then you'll reason that, you know, a good few million years of evolution, you know, just built people with a few wires crossed, so that occasionally a happy occasion makes you cry. You know, what can you do? When we advance out of the stage of being this kind of gorilla, then, you know, maybe that'll get better. But obviously that's not what's happening. There's a certain kind of crying that happens at that occasion. What happens then is, you cry through the experience, and then the happiness begins after that. The crying is happiness also. That's what happens. But there are many, many facets to it. That's one facet. That doesn't have to be explained. You either understand it or you don't. Women understand this kind of thing much better. Men take a lot of a lifetime to get any sensitivity. But that's what it says. Now, if men understood any of the sensitivity that women had, they would never do to women what they do to them. If women had more sense, they would bring up men in such a way, train their men in such a way. Anyway, that's another story. Now, like this. One of the aspects of the crying, it says, will be this. One of the aspects of the crying of the messianic phase will be as follows. It says that the families will cry. Why will they cry? They'll cry with tremendous sadness. Why? Because it says, Vasiresi mikem es lev ha'evin, I will take away from you the heart of stone, v'nasati lachem lev basar, and I will give you a heart of flesh. That means when the Mashiach comes, Hashem will take away the heart of stone that we have and give us a heart, a real heart, heart of flesh. So I heard a great Rosh Yeshiva explain it, very great man. He said that what it means is this, that right now we have a heart that is so hardened we can't experience anything. The emotions that we experience, that we think are great and powerful emotions, are just the tip of a massive iceberg of what human emotion really is, understanding really is. Prophecy and that phase of the world's history when things were, everything was life-size, that's how it was. But now we have access to almost nothing. Why is that? Everything Hashem does is for a reason. He says, because the agony that the world has gone through and the agony that the world's going through now is so great that if you felt any of it, you couldn't function. You hear that? If you felt any of the agony, really understood what was happening, even just to one family that's not having a good time, or to one person who's suffering, Especially if you understood what had happened to your family. You understood in your family what happened 2 generations ago and what it meant. If you really understood what it meant, you wouldn't be able to function. But because Hashem has given us a heart of stone, so you're able to live through those things and you function. You wake up in the morning, you're not thinking about it. You think about it for a few days, a few months, it tails off, it tapers off, and then you function again. Which is not, you see, if you think about it logically, it's embarrassing because it seems very insensitive. Terrible, terrible things happen and you forget about them and just function. You even have a good time. Go out and enjoy yourself. It's very insensitive. Actually, it's not insensitive. It is insensitive, but we built that way. The example he gave was an incredible example. He knew the Ponovitch Arov. The Ponovitch Arov was the man who founded the Yeshiva Ponovitch in Eretz Yisrael. And he was a man who lived through the war, and he lost his whole family. He lost a wife and 10 children. They were all murdered during the war. And afterwards, he came out, and he built Ponovitch. He built one of the greatest yeshivas in the world that was responsible, almost single-handed in many ways, for continuing the Torah tradition that was smashed and killed off in that generation, being the bridge that brought it over into this generation. So this great Rosh Hashiva said that he wouldn't have been able to do that if he had had a human heart. If he had had the heart, the way a human really feels these things, he wouldn't have been able to function. To go through an experience like that with a full sensitivity that a human being should have for such things, it would break you completely. Not because you're weak, but because you're sensitive and you understand what it means. But he was given, if we were given a heart of stone, and therefore we're insensitive to those things, the function of it being so we can function. It's an incredible idea. Why the world has to go through those things to put us in that situation is not tonight's subject. I'll discuss that another time. So he said like this, when the Mashiach comes and the tension's over, so then what will happen is Hashem will give us a real heart. He'll take away the heart of stone and give us a heart of flesh. And that's when the crying will begin. Because then people, families will understand what happened to them. Then people won't be able to just be insensitive to what's happened anymore. And the pain that's all flowed under the, down the river, under the bridge, that all will be felt instantaneously all at once. And that's when the crying will begin. And then after that, people understand it, and after that, the happiness will begin. But that's what it will be. So you see that we're going through a phase where we have that insensitivity. Now, it says like this, that because what happened and our sensitivity to it is divorced, so you have many examples of that kind of divorce in the world. And what it means, a rushing witness, is this, that the way the world is designed is with cause and effect. We have a cause and it generates an effect. The natural pathway is to see the cause the effect. And you link the effect to the cause. But the way the world functions in darkness is that the cause happens and the effect doesn't happen till later. Or it happens in a hidden way. Usually the way it's hidden is that it's separated from the cause in time. So what happens is you don't understand that this cause caused that effect. And in classic examples, I mean the classic ones are in a relationship between two people. One person does something, the other person doesn't show the emotion at the time, or even if they do, the person who did the damage doesn't choose to see it. And later, somewhere way down the line, there's a fracture in the relationship, or the whole relationship is not what it should be, and they never realize even that it's because of the thing they said or did, or many things they've been doing or saying. And you are free not to see the one as the result of the other. On a societal scale, they say that there are certain disasters that happen to the world because of social misbehavior. If people behave in an abnormal way, then certain consequences will happen. That's what the mystics say. I'm not going to give examples because there should be people who will argue. I don't feel like getting into arguments. If people behave in an abnormal or perverted way, then for sure the consequences will happen and they'll be disastrous. If people don't continue family life the way they should, they take chances and they don't value and put what a family should be on a pedestal, what will happen is a breakdown of the family and will cause the breakdown of society. And the pain will be felt by the same. But the only thing is it doesn't happen immediately. So, he says, V'hayisi eid mamayr, I will be a rushing witness. A rushing witness means that the more messianic revelation, the more the revelation is made apparent to us, the more close together will come the cause and the effect until you won't be able to mistake them. That you follow. That means the Chofetz Chaim gave an incredible example. He said he died in 1933. So he never saw the modern age. He never saw what we've been going through in the last 50 years. The Chofetz Chaim said, he made the following statement once. He said that it takes today many, many months. Today it takes many a long period of time, it could be many years or centuries for certain changes to occur. He said, we're entering a phase where changes that took centuries will take months or less. Right? That's what he said. And it will happen exponentially. He explained that it says in mystical things, there's a wheel that turns in the world and it goes faster and faster, that's what it means. And if you think about it, if you consider the world in the 1930s, the world then was a world where events that took centuries, there were events then that definitely took centuries. Today, they don't take months. Today, you can't keep up with them with the fastest news cost. You can't get, if you looked at the map of Africa or any part of the world, of the third world certainly, in the 1920s or 30s, the map hadn't changed,
since maybe 5 centuries before that, to set up a colony for a country to change hands, for the rulership and the name and the government of a country to change hands, was a matter that took centuries, literally centuries. But I promise you, I'm virtually prepared to guarantee that nobody in this room could draw a map of Africa today and even name the countries. Well, people have given up even trying. And when I was at school, you had to do that. You had to name the countries. Today it's hopeless to get the kids to do it because it changes overnight. That's the way it goes. You can't even keep up anymore with who's in power and who's being toppled. The whole thing also explained because they said the scores to be settled and that's why many changes have to be gone through. But the point is that the world, the history, things are speeding up. The technological advancement goes together with it. It's the tool, the vessel that enables it. But that's the way it goes. And in the end, the cause and effect will be so rapid. Already you're seeing it with social misbehavior, certain perversions. There's no way anymore that you can consider it to just, you know, ignore, unless you really are intent on putting your head in the sand. But otherwise, you can see the cause the effect much more quickly. Now, so what do we get out of all this? That we live in a world now where there's darkness. It's getting faster and it's coming, the light is appearing. But still, you can choose to see what you want and not see what you want. When prophecy was around, there was none of that. That's what we're getting at. When there was Nevuah around in the world, even if you weren't a Navi or spoke to a prophet, you had an extra special connection with the divine power, but nevertheless, the world itself spoke to you. Are you with me? And so you couldn't make mistakes. You couldn't pretend that no one was watching. You just couldn't do that. You witnessed miracles all the time. You yourself had access to see transcendent phenomena all the time. You know, if you go today to speak to somebody who has a little bit of insight into another world, not I had my first experience with witch doctors. What can I tell you? It's not the way you should be a Balchiva. It's not the way. But that's what happened to me. And I had to admit that there was a world that you couldn't access in the normal way. I mean, amazing things. I'm not going to tell you about them because this is a sharing Torah, not in voodoo. But the point is, I saw that. And after that, when a person becomes familiar and you move around in the Torah world and you meet people of greatness, I've explained to you before, I've given you on Saturday night, I mentioned many times how I've sat personally with people of greatness, and I think everybody should go and do this. I don't see how you can develop at all unless you do have these kind of experiences. I've sat down with people who don't function in the Kabbalistic world at all. The Kabbalists is nothing to talk about. But I've sat with ordinary, Litvisha Rosh Hashivas, people who would never admit to you that they touch a Kabbalistic zone. And before opening my mouth, they'll tell me what the question is that I came to ask and answer the question. Now, that's happened to me, Kaseida, with people who would be, you know, who leave the room if you mention a Kabbalistic wisdom. We have to experience those things. You have to become aware that there's a certain clarity that a person can tune into, that even when you see a thing like that, you can't be the same again. But imagine living in a world where you personally experience the electricity. So the problem we want to understand is, how could you do anything wrong? How could these people have made the mistakes that they made? Are you with me? Do you have the problem? It took quite a long time to say the question. Right? But, yeah. So this is what we have to understand. It's a fundamental idea in understanding the Neshama, and it will lead us to an understanding of prophecy and many of the things we have to understand. So we have the following axiom. First I'll tell you the principle, and then we'll try and fill it out together. The principle is this. I'm going to tell you now a principle that you must hear this clearly, okay? This idea now has to be absolutely clear. First of all, it will explain many, many things in life. Many, many things that you've wondered about in life will be explained with it as you use this principle. But it's going to explain the rest of what we're going to discuss this evening. So you must have this idea clear. And the idea is as follows. There's nothing in the world that's either positive or negative. There's only power. Again, there's nothing in the world that's intrinsically good or intrinsically bad. The world doesn't work that way. There's only more power or less power. The thing is, what you use the power for, you channel it into something that has a positive end product or something that has a negative end product. You channel it, or other forces channel it. But the thing itself is not called good or bad. Examine the world, you don't have to take this from me, you can examine it and see. Money, for example. Money isn't good or bad, it's just powerful. You have a lot of money, you have a lot of power. You could do a tremendous good with it and tremendous destruction. And by the way, the spiritual rule is they equal each other. The potential for goodness in the world exactly balances the potential for destruction that you could do, with certain exceptions that I'm not going to go into now. But that's what it is. If a person's good looking, let's say, good looks aren't good. Good looks are a certain kind of power in the world. With good looks, you can do certain things in the world that cause tremendous destruction, and you can do certain things that are very powerful for goodness in the world. Or a talent that you have in your personality. Let's say you can communicate well with people. Or you're sensitive to people's feelings. So you can use that to fool people and cause havoc in the world. And you can use it for good. And so it goes on. Electricity. The more electricity you have, so the more power you can do in the world. But the more you'll get fried if you put your finger in the plug. You follow. It always works both ways. The more powerful it is, the better it is. And the more dangerous it is. That's the rule. Now, it means this. You can understand also that one of the reasons for the ending of prophecy was the fact that when that power was around in the world, so there was incredible goodness and positivity that could be generated, but there was tremendous evil that it could be used for. And because people were getting into a phase where they tended maybe to connect and draw into the evil area, the negative, the black area, they tried to draw the power in, so it wasn't worth having that power around anymore. Even though you have to sacrifice all the good that can be done. Right? The Beis HaMikdash is the same idea. We'll try and understand this idea. So now, let's understand it in the neshama. Okay? Now, again, here we come to an example I'm going to give you. This, to understand for yourself. The words, the best that I can do, but they may not be adequate. But if you're sensitive to your own inner life, then you can understand this idea. And that's as follows. When a person has, listen carefully, when a person has added potential in their neshama for greatness, then they have an added drive to evil. When a person has the power, and they feel that they wield a certain amount of power, and they, even if they have intention to use the power for good, but then they have an added drive to use it for negativity. That's the way it is. And exactly the same. Exactly the same. It means if you find somebody who's very saintly and generates enormous positivity in the world, you should know that hiding inside him is the blackest individual imaginable. Because the power that he has, there's a famous medrash that I might have mentioned to you once that illustrated beautifully. This is, again, from the Midrashic ideas which are not meant to be understood physically. Literally, yes. Literally, yes, but physically, maybe not. And it says that there was a man once, the idea is perfectly, you see, illustrates exactly. There was a king once who heard of Moses. He heard of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he heard what an incredible man he was. So he would desperately wanted to see this man, because Moshe Rabbeinu looked amazing. You know, it says he stood 10 amas tall, that's about 5 meters. 5 meters tall, he had a light that shone from his face that the people of his generation couldn't bear to look at. That he was an incandescent human being. I mean, it was that generation that stood at Sinai couldn't bear to look at him. So this king wanted a picture, he wanted to see him. So he sent a painter, he had a famous painter, who in those days, this painter was so great that he could paint a likeness that was exactly like a mirror. Perfect, perfect lifelike likeness of the individual. So he sent him off to the desert, to Midbar Sinai, where the Jews were wandering, to paint a picture of this great man, so he'd bring back and see it. So the man went off, and he saw Moshe Rabbeinu, and he painted a picture, and he brought back to the king, wherever he lived, a painting of the most hideously evil-looking man imaginable. Screamingly, frighteningly ugly. The picture was almost impossible to look at, it was so evil, so black. So the king, there are versions of the story. One is he had the painter killed, and he went to see for himself. Another one is, but according to all versions, he went to see for himself, and he took the picture with him. So the Midrash goes like this. He arrived in the desert, and he walked up to see Moshe Rabbeinu, and he saw the most beautiful man imaginable, a man of incandescent beauty, luminous beauty. So he was perplexed. He walked up to him, and he said, and he saw that the beauty of the man was as great as the evil of this painting, was evil. So he said to him, what's going on? I see you, and I sent my painter to paint this painting of you. And he showed Moshe Rabbeinu the picture, and Moshe Rabbeinu said, yes, that's me, but I worked on myself. In other words, so you have your, so what do we have is like this. Now, let's try and translate that. Now, you have to either feel that, you either know it or you don't know it. Now, let's try and understand. Let's try and put it in Torah terms. The Torah sources say this. When a person has a potential for greatness, when he's locked into the world of greatness, the world of Emes, truth, and he can see certain things as prophetic insight, what Hashem does is, listen well, he takes that power and he channels it into the person's negative side in a full coupling, so that the person has a drive to negativity as great as he does to positive. It's called the Yetzer Hara, right? The person's own negative inclination. He has a destructive power, you know, which is, sometimes you see it in relationships also. You see, sometimes you, there was a famous play written about it, I'm not going to quote English literature here, but where you often find in a man-woman relationship, men often get into this phase, a kind of a self-destructive kind of phase where the love and power of the relationship, they turn against the relationship itself. That's part of this idea. And the more sensitive and subtle they are, the more potent the damage can be. Again, you either know that or you don't. Now, that's what it is. So like this. So what do we have from this? We have the following thing. In a generation when you have prophecy, you have people walking around who have incandescent spiritual glow, and they have the most hideously evil power that's generated in their neshamas. These people have a drive, you follow? It was a generation of people who had access to the truth. They were connected to a channel of such potency that made them glow with power, but all that energy was also connected up to negativity. And they were, we'll understand, we'll try and understand a little bit together how. And that energy was so great that they could do. Let me tell you, let me give you an example. The Gemara says this. Are you with me so far? Gemara says the following example. Gemara says this. There was a man, Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi was one of the last Amoraim who edited the Gemara. Rav Ashi, one day it says, late, he lived in the year approximately 400, about 1500 years ago, long after the closing of prophecy, a few centuries after the closing of the era of prophecy. So it says, Rav Ashi one day walked into the basement, and he started to give a shiur. So he said to all the Talmidim, the students sitting around, he was the great man of his day, he said, he wanted to give a shiur about previous generations, about a king called Menashe. Menashe was one of the great kings of Israel, descended from the house of David, if I'm not mistaken, one of the great kings who engaged in idolatry. He was a very frum man. He kept Torah, but also he had certain idolatrous elements in the country at the time, which is impossible for us to understand. Because a Jewish king had to carry a Torah around with him all the time. He had to carry a Sefer Torah with him. He went into battle, he had to carry a Sefer Torah. He kept the Torah punctiliously. But he had certain idolatrous elements in the country, very difficult to understand. But because he was a man who was involved in, well, it's not so difficult after what we said this evening, but you'll see a bit more. Because he had this idolatrous element in his background, so Rav Ashi wanted to give a shir about him, he wanted to teach about him, and he wanted to say it in a derogatory fashion. Why? He wasn't a jocular or a man given to put other people down, but there's a halacha that you shouldn't mock anything in the world. By the way, you should know this halacha. It's forbidden for a Jew to mock anything. Mockery is a terrible... The faculty of mockery destroys your neshama. Right? You shouldn't mock. But there's one thing in the world that you're allowed to mock, and it's a mitzvah, and that's avodah zarah. Idolatry. The opposite of the truth in the world. When the opposite of the truth in the world is set up as the truth, then it's a mitzvah to mock it and bring it down. Because it is a mockery of the truth. Do you follow? When they take something in the world that's idolatrous, that's non-emes, that's sheker in the world, that's not the truth, and they set it up as the truth, there couldn't be a bigger mockery of Hashem in the world. The only way to destroy that is by mocking that, and you're allowed to do it. And that's why you'll see in the prophets, they always mock, the prophet who says, these people take a tree, they cut the log, they cut half the log, and they make a fire out of it. They burn their fire, the rest of it they make a chair out of, and the rest they make a god out of, and they worship it. And he says it like a joke, you know, to explain. So, Rav Ashi wanted to apply this rule of mockery. So he walked into the basement and he said like this. He said, Niftach b'chavroi. That means, let us speak about our friends. But the word means like, as if in English, a vague echo of it in English would be, let's speak about our buddies. Something like that. Like a very slighting reference he made to the King Menashe. You see? And he gave a shir about the King Menashe. Speaking about him in a very, putting him down in that way. So that night it says he had a dream. By the way, a dream is the 60th of prophecy, as you're about to see. He had a dream that night. In the dream, Menashe appeared to him. The King Menashe appeared to him in a dream. So Menashe said to him, who are you calling your friend? So Rav Ashi was very surprised. So Menashe said to him the following thing. Do you know, and he asked him a question in Halacha. He asked him a question in Torah. Very interesting question about where you cut the bread. Very interesting question. I'm not going to go into it now. He asked him a question in Halacha, how you make a motzi and you cut the bread. So Rav Ashi didn't know the answer. So Menashe told him the answer to the question. So Rav Ashi said to him, I didn't know you were such an amazing Talmid Chacham. You know such amazing depth in Torah. You're so learned and so great in Torah that I, as the leader of my generation, I didn't know that. So if you're that great, how come you worship idolatry? You follow? You had idolatrous elements in your... How could you do that? He couldn't understand. So Menashe said to him like this, if you, listen carefully, if you would have lived in my generation, you would have picked up your coattails to run to Avodah Zarah. You know, they wore long garments in those days. They were long. You would have picked up, not only would you have run, but you would have not only run as fast as you could, you would have taken away any obstruction to get there faster. We at least walked what's called heel to toe. We walked in a dignified fashion. Sure, we walked Avodah Zarah, but at least we had the control that we walked slowly and dignified. You would have run with all your energy. Suddenly, Rav Ashi understood what he was being told. He understood that Menashe lived in a generation, you have to hear this well, he lived in a generation where the potency of the human neshama was so great that he had access to prophecy. So that energy filtered in and gave him access to the most evil point of contact in the world. It had to be that way. It had to be that way. So the next day it says, Rav Ashi walked into the Beis Midrash and he said, Niftach barov ravoi. Let us give a shir about our teachers. He said. But the idea you see from this Gemara is as follows. That what I explained before. Now, what is the reason? Well, I'm trying to say that. The reason is like this. Just give one dimension of a reason. The reason is this. Because if a person had access to greatness, and he had an energy of potency and positivity in his neshama, And he did not have an equal and opposite drive in his neshama. First of all, let's just go in order. I don't want to mislead you. First of all, the reason when you have the potential for greatness that you also have the potential for negativity, there's not a reason. It's the same thing. It is you. Do you follow me? It can't be any other way. Electricity can't be only good and not give you a shock when you touch it. It's energy. Whichever you channel it into, that's what it's going to be. It has to be that way. But if you want to put it into Musa terms, if you want to understand why the world is created that way, if you like, then the answer is as follows. Because if you had energy that drove you to positivity, and you didn't have the same energy driving you to negativity, you'd never be able to do anything wrong. You wouldn't have free choice. You follow? As soon as a person grows to a level where they grasp certain positivity, and they function that way, if you don't have an equal force tempting you in the opposite direction, so you're not a free choice anymore. You're not worth living. The whole point of being here, which is another discussion, but the whole point of being here is to have free choice. To have free choice, you have to be equally pulled to the right and to the left. Then you make the decision. But if you pulled much, are you with me? And therefore, you know, if two options are placed in front of you, one is obviously correct and it's going to save your life, and the other one's obviously wrong, that's not called choice. That's not called choice. That's not free choice. That's the kind of free choice angels have. Technically you can choose, but who's going to choose wrong? So Hashem never puts a human being in the world that way. What he does is, he puts you in a situation where the two options are both doubtful. Isn't that how life is? That's what they say. Our terrible ordeal is that we put in a situation where what we have is doubt. Our problem isn't having the guts to do what's right. Our problem is having the faintest inkling of what's right. That's our problem. And since both sides of the picture are dark, so you're in balance. So the Moshim say in that generation what happened was, they had a tremendous insight into the truth, into positivity. They had miracles around showing them what was true. Now, if you want to take a person who has prophecy and miracles, and he sees the truth so clearly, and you want to make him free to choose, well, you have to give him such a drive for negativity that's almost uncontrollable. Are you with me? That's what you have to do. If you find a man in the gutter, and he doesn't know the difference between right and wrong, and he thinks mugging people is right, so an ordeal for him is a puny. You come up with anything's an ordeal for him. He doesn't know the difference between right and wrong. You probably have to stress him. But if you have a person of tremendous moral standing, who really knows what's right in the world, and has given his life for that, so for him, to stress him, you have to give him an incredible test. You follow? You have to tell him to take his son and kill him. That's what you have to do. You follow a man that great? What else can you do to stress him or a woman? So the principle we have is like this. In the days of prophecy, what was going on was this. You had people of intense connection to the positive spiritual forces. But because of that, they were completely open to the negative side, and that's why they fell into errors as great as they did. Errors that we would never make today. We wouldn't make the mistakes they made. You're right, we wouldn't make those mistakes. But not because we're better than them. We're not better than them. We don't begin to be the bottom of the toe, the bottom of the feet of what they were. That's why we wouldn't make those mistakes. I gave you once an example. I'll just give you one more example, and we'll try and see what happened to prophecy. The Gemara says, you see, with what we've explained tonight, it's much easier to understand. The Gemara says that once when we discussed free will, I can't remember if it was on Sunday or Monday night, but we used this example, classic example. The Gemara says, let me give you this example and I'll refer you to the cassettes where we spoke a few months ago on Monday night about free will in general, where we tried to explore the whole area. It's an essential subject to understand. Cannot move ahead without understanding that subject. So I would suggest that you get the cassette of that discussion where I tried my best to go through the basic elements of that subject. We can't go through it all now, but I'll just give you one example. The Gemara says that Abaye, one of the great sages in a generation not far from Rav Ashi's generation, once he spent the night in a hotel and he heard a young man and a young woman speaking. I suppose the walls are very thin. And they were said to each other the following thing. Let's travel together in the morning. Well, he heard them in the foyer, I don't know. They went, let's travel together in the morning. We're going in the same direction. Let's walk together. So Abaye was horrified because he knew they'd be going out in the fields and the forest. They'd be alone together, so they might sin. So he thought he couldn't let this happen to this young Jewish boy and girl. So he said, he'll follow them at a distance. And if he sees them doing anything they shouldn't be doing, you know, he'll cough politely or, I don't know, what he'll do. Doesn't say that in the Gemara, but. So, the next morning this young couple set out bright and early. They were strangers to each other. And they set out, and Abaye followed them at a safe distance, hidden from them. And they walked through the forests and the fields and all, plenty of lonely places, and nothing happened. And finally they came to a fork in the road, and he said, thanks for the company. She said, nice knowing you, and they parted company. So Abaye was heartbroken. He went back to town and he started crying. It says he put his head on a door jamb and he started crying. So an old sage came past and he said, why are you crying? So Abaye said, he told him the story and he said the following words, if I would have been that young man, I definitely would have sinned with that girl. Now the Gemara doesn't say any words that are loosely used, and Abaye never said a word of a lie. That means if he gave testimony about himself that he would have done something wrong,
he definitely would have. And here was this young man who hadn't worked on himself at all. He was just an ordinary young man. He hadn't reached any level of spiritual greatness, and he managed to control the temptation. So Abaya was heartbroken. He thought, all the work I've done on myself for all these years, and I've reached nothing. So the sage laughed at him, and he said, I don't know if he laughed at him, but he said, you don't understand. It's because you're as great as you are that you would have had your ordeal. You follow? Which is a very interesting thing, because it means that the ordeals aren't only at a more subtle level, they also come and hit you below the belt at a level that you long ago surpassed also. Which means a man of greatness is not only struggling against more sensitive and subtle ordeals, he's also struggling with things that he long ago passed as much beneath his level. That's especially that area, and especially for men. Other areas don't apply so much to that. Now, so we have the following thing. That was that generation. Prophecy was around, and it had this incredible voltage, and its positivity was what they could do with it, but its tremendous risk was that it could draw people into death. And when the balance in the world became such that the Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin, that great body of sages who lived at that time, this was the end of the period of the Sanhedrin, just after all the prophets died. At the end of prophecy, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the last three prophets were alive at that time. At the end of that era, when those prophets were no longer in the world, and the Sanhedrin was making the changes to Jewish life that were going to carry us through from that generation till the Mashiach comes, so they did the following thing. They saw that this force of revelation, of the Beis HaMikdash, of prophecy, that this force in the world was so great that the risk of having it around was greater than the benefit. That's what they decided. It was up to them, incredible. This is where all the stories of exorcism come from, you'll see. They decided it wasn't worth it. So let me tell you how the Gemara puts it. The Gemara says the following thing. Stay with me now. The Gemara says this. They decided that the Yetzer Hara, the negative drive that people had for idolatry, right, for the negative side of Kedusha, that means idolatry, Kedusha, Nevuah, prophecy, is connecting up to the positive channel. Idolatry is the wish to connect with a source that's the opposite of the positive channel. Right? That drive was so great, they saw that it wasn't worth having in the world. So they said to Hashem like this. This is what they did, incredible thing. They said, Hashem, we know that you've put this drive in the world just to give us reward. The reason that we have this incredible attraction to this negativity, like Menashe who ran towards it, or the generation that ran or would have run towards it, we know that you've given it to us to resist. And by resisting this temptation, you give us incredible reward. But Hashem, we don't want the reward. We don't want the risk, and we don't want the reward. Unfortunately, we're not strong enough anymore to be sure of ourselves. By the way, it's a big lesson this in Musa. A person should always put himself in a situation where he's forced to do what's right. You shouldn't put yourself in a situation where you are stressed and trust yourself to do right. You should put yourself, when there's no ordeal, in a situation where later there won't be an ordeal. That's the right way to handle ordeals. Not to go into the lion's den and then fight the lion, but to walk around the mountain where the lion's place is and never have to meet him. Except the trouble is we don't realize it. We think life's got to be full of drama. So we march in without thinking about it, and then there's a lion that's struggling with you. You're struggling with. But that's not the way to handle ordeals. That's the message you get here. They said to Hashem like this. We know that it's here for reward, but unfortunately, we can't risk trying to gain the reward from this force, because the risk that it might put us down and kill us is too great. And therefore, we wish to have it not be in the world anymore. So what did they do? Let's understand what power these people had. We're talking about a generation of the world's history that was still at the root of human, that means the neshama. You must understand, today we're fragments of broken pieces. Not anything today human compared to what they were. They were enormous, enormous neshamas. They held the history of the world in their hands, literally. So the Gemara says they did this. They got together and they exorcised, they called up the Yetzer. Listen to this. They called up the Yetzer. That means they called up the drive in the human neshama that wants to make a person attached to the negative forces in the world. And it came flaming out of the Kodesh Kodoshim. You hear that? It came flaming out of the holiest place on earth. Now the holiest place on earth was the Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies in the Beis HaMikdash. And it came out there as a flame. And of course that's where, first of all, it's a flame that's not hard to understand. But why it comes out of the Kodesh Kodoshim is because, after what we discussed this evening, it shouldn't be a problem to understand. The place where that evil force lives is in the holiest place on earth. Is that correct? Because it's the center of the universe, and that's exactly what it is. It's not another force. It's exactly the same thing. And this incredibly evil flame, this flame that was the flame of all humans on earth, their drive to negativity, swirled around in front of them, and they killed it. They said, Hashem, we don't want it, and we don't want its reward, and they took it out of the world. And from that time on,
Listen to this. From that time on, no human ever had a drive to worship idolatry. If you've ever wondered why Tanakh is so full of people bowing down to images and worshipping idols, and why it is that today no human has the faintest desire to worship an idol. I don't understand what idols are. It doesn't mean graven images. It means the graven representation. That's when it disappeared. We don't have that drive anymore. I'll just complete the Gemara for you because it's fascinating to know. You don't mind another 5 minutes, right? We start a little bit late. 5 minutes? I'm not offended if you leave. Like this. The Gemara says this. That just to complete the Gemara, it's the same idea. Same idea. And I'll mention it for that reason. While they saw, listen to this, this is people of greatness. They were dealing with a force that's at the core of the world, the center of the world. While they saw they were dealing with it and they were managing, they decided to take it further. While you're winning, when you're ahead, press your advantage. So they said the following thing. While we're at it, Hashem, give us a chance to deal with the sexual yetzer as well. They also caused a lot of problems. Tremendous problems in the world. Can you imagine if you didn't have that as a problem in the world? Things would be fine. So they called it up. They called it up, you hear this? And they shechted it. They killed it. They took away the drive to the sensual area. They shechted it in the world and it died. So Gemara says 3 days later there were no eggs. You hear that? There wasn't a fresh egg in Israel. Because the chickens, once you take that thing out of the world, the chickens weren't making eggs. The Gemara says that there wasn't even an egg laid, you hear this? There wasn't even an egg laid that had been inside the chickens before. Not only didn't they form new eggs, but even the eggs that were already in the chickens didn't come out. Why? Because their body temperature dropped. When they took away that yater in the world cooled down. And even the eggs that were being cooked didn't cook, didn't come out. Think it late. So they brought it back quick. Because they said the world's going to die. They brought it back. And once I think they tried a 3-day experiment. They brought it back. And then they said, but they were very powerful people. They said, Hashem, like this. Of course you understand. But let's finish the story, you'll see. So they said like this. Listen, Hashem, before we bring it back, this is what they said to themselves. Before we bring it back, let's bring it back half. Let's bring back the drive that a man has for a woman, but not for his, but only for his wife. You hear that? Let's bring back into the world the sensual drive that a man has for his wife, but let's not bring into the world the drive that a man has for other women. It would be fantastic. Imagine what the world would look like. So they got a message from heaven, from Shemayim. It says like a min Shemaya lo yahavi palga. In heaven they don't give halves. That's what it says. Yeah, you take it all or nothing. That's what they said. So they brought the whole thing back into the world. Why is this? Why? Of course, you have to understand what's going on here. This is not, if you've got a childish picture of people sitting around in a circle, you know, like with white hoods on, you know, with big stones perched up behind them and they're busy doing witchcraft. That's not the idea. We're talking here about the most sensitive inner elements of what the human heart understands. But, of course, why they can't give halves, as you well understand, you can't take out an organ from the body, you follow. If you take out the liver, then you don't have any of the functions of the liver. You follow me? You can't take out an organ from the body and expect half the functions to remain. If you do surgery on the neshama, if you take out part of the neshama, so then all the functions of that part of the neshama go. You follow? You can't mess around. So they couldn't. But it says they managed an incredible achievement. They managed to bring back this drive that men have for women. It says they managed to bring it back blind. What does blind mean, the Gemara says? That a man from that time on would have a drive for women, but not for his mother or sister. You hear that? Because until that time it had been a massive problem. That a man would have a natural drive for any woman who was attractive to him, but not if she was a close relative, which is an incredible thing if you think about it. Why a man functions that way is very hard to understand. There are many people who have mothers or sisters who are very attractive. In fact, if you just want to know about it, you look at people who aren't their mothers and some brothers or whatever it is, and you'll see they're very attractive. But the people who are brothers or sons or whatever of these people, unless you, the Bible must say you can train yourself to be attracted. You can train yourself into perversion. You can train yourself to be driven by things that you don't have a natural drive for. But we're not talking about that now. Anyway, that's what they did. But you see from the story what we try to illustrate. Now, let's get back to the mainstream. Are you with me? So like this. You see that they exorcised, they took out this koyach in the neshama. What happened as a result, listen well now. What happened as a result was this. You've got the scene, there was a Sanhedrin, they called up this drive to Avodah Zarah. Let's leave out the sensual thing for now. Though you'll see it connects tremendously deeply. They pulled in the drive that we have to idolatry and they killed it. When they killed it, you know what happened? Prophecy ended. You hear that? Nebuah ended. The last prophet ceased to be. That was it. No prophecy anymore. Why? Obviously, after what we've worked so hard as even to try and explain, you see that the drive to idolatry is exactly the same drive to prophecy. It's the same channel. It's the same energy. It's the same organ. If you have an organ in the neshama, let's call it that, a limb, part of the neshama of the soul, that can connect to the energy in the world, the positive source of energy, and that's the thing that drives you to the negative, to seek channels, to drink in the power that comes through the channels in nature, which is real energy, as we've explained before, then if you take out the drive to drink in from the channels, so then you have to take out the organ. You can't take half. So you take out that connection. Once you chop out that connection, so then you've got no connection to anything. You're not going to hear any prophecy after that. Once you take away the sensitivity, are you with me? Once you take away the sensitivity that people have to drink in from the channels where nature pours down its power, so then you're not going to have the sensitivity to take from the source of the channels of power in nature either, and then it died. So from that moment on, you hear what they did to the world? They put people into the world who would now live in darkness. The benefit, the tragedy of it would be, as they well knew, that they would be half human compared to what they were before, or much less than that. They would have seen nothing, they would know nothing of the world, they would know nothing of Hashem's presence. Incredible. Right? It says in the next generation, two or three generations later, the founder of Christianity was born. First of all, two generations, one generation before him, Tzaddok and Baitis were born, the people who began the reform movement. The original concept of reform, Judaism, began then, and they perverted Judaism from there, it says. And two generations later, the founder of Christianity was born, he was born on the day that Ezra died. The last of the great assembly, Ezra, the man who did all this, who was responsible for it, the day he died, that man was born. And it says that as Ezra and his men came to seal off Tanakh and end prophecy, that religion began in the world to open Tanakh again and to reopen prophecy, so to speak, which we don't agree with. We're not going to discuss that in detail. That's what happened. Now, so you see this, that the consequence, right, was, what did they remove? What was that organ? And I'll finish with this, unless you have some questions. What was it that they removed? They didn't just remove a piece of the neshama, they removed the center. They didn't just take away, you follow me? They didn't just take away a part of the neshama, you know, the appreciation of music, let's say, or some other peripheral aspect. They didn't take that away. They took away the center of the neshama. They took away the highest point. The neshama has levels. They took away, if you like, the point where the top end of the neshama can connect to the bottom end of where the power comes from. You follow? They blocked the channel. That's what they did. They left us. It's like, you follow? It's like a person without his head. It's not like a person without his foot or without his hand. It's a person without the top of his consciousness. The most refined and elevated element that you could ever rise to, they stopped that. Now all you can ever do in your highest meditation and your highest insight is generate a level where you can just begin to have a feeling that there may be something somewhere, that's all. But clarity you'll never have. The top level's been taken away, except for a dream here and there, or a flash of inspiration, or what a person can get inspired through Torah when they see clarity through various means and techniques, but that's what they did. And the idea I just want to give you as an example, as an illustration, which is spine-chilling, is this. Just to connect it with what we spoke about the last week or two, I think we spoke about this on Monday night, we spoke about Lashon Hora, right? What is the spiritual depth of saying words that are negative, of using the power of speech for negativity? So, the mystics say something like this, it's an incredible idea, and again, just feel it with your neshama. I can't prove it to you and I can't even say the words adequately. But if you know anything about life at all, then immediately this will connect. They say this. When you take away a part of the neshama, let's put it this way. When you take away an organ from the body, you leave an empty space. When you take away part of the neshama, you also leave an empty space. You can't take away, you can't have nothingness. You have to have something there. Right? You have to replace, you have to fill that space. Or at least you have a space there. You have a scar. You have a place with it. Right? Now, when you take away the drive, the part of the neshama that connects to the truth, right, that drives potently into where the energy is and draws down the energy from there, positive or negative, that organ, when that's taken away, the power of connection to meaning and to the depth of meaning in the world, when you take that away, what does the empty space that's left behind look like? You hear that question? That's the kind of question a mystic will ask. You hear that? We're doing surgery, right? We've got this human being. At the top of his consciousness, it's an incredible idea, this. At the top of his consciousness, you have, it's one of the deepest mystical worlds. At the top of his consciousness, you have a connection to the higher world. That connection means that he's able to connect with meaning, ultimate meaning, the reality in the world. And it's a drive, an unquenchable drive for that reality, one way or the other. When you take away that energy, you excise that piece of the neshama in the world, what are you left with? They answer the following thing. The drive to nonsense. the drive to things that are a waste of time. The drive to things that are, you hear that? Before that generation, no human being would ever have a drive to waste time. It's a suicide. Nobody would ever want badly to waste his time. You follow? It's the most ridiculous thing there could ever be. Nobody would ever enjoy, until that generation, talking nonsense. If people got together and sat around and somebody spoke nonsense for an hour, it would have been the most painful experience anybody could imagine. They would watch a person killing himself. Because that half hour will never come again. Are you with me? You're not a dying person will give for another half hour anything. So how could a person take half an hour of his life and do something that's not going to have any meaning attached to it? That's not going to be connected to the source? Inconceivable. And today, that's the major human activity. When people aren't busy doing damage in the world, they're busy wasting time. Is that right? What the greatest pleasure there is, and the mystics use this to explain, I heard this from a very great man, why is it, in all of the Mephoshim you'll see that the punishment for wasted words, the punishment for words that you say, what's called Varim Batanim, it doesn't only mean words, it means all activity where you spend your energy of life doing nothing, killing time as they say, it's really killing time, the punishment is intense, terrible. Why? Says in Mephoshim, the reason the punishment is so great is because you had no pleasure out of it. You hear that? If you did something that was sinful, that your body really got pleasure out of, that you craved, so then you're going to have not so much punishment in the next world, because you'll be able to say, Hashem, it wasn't my fault, you gave me a drive. I got intense pleasure out of that area, so I couldn't resist it. But if you engaged yourself doing things that you didn't get any pleasure out of, like when you speak badly about somebody, you say bad things about somebody else, what benefit do you have? What pleasurable feeling do you get? Or you sit around for an hour talking nonsense, what pleasure is there in that? Therefore, you're going to get punished much worse, because you did it out of willful evil. So the Mephoshim said like this, one second, I don't understand, it's very pleasurable. What do you mean? To sit around for an hour and talk absolute nonsense is fantastic. That's a tremendous pleasure. What do you mean? People do almost nothing else. You hear that? The answer is, absolutely. The way the world should be, that would be the most unbearable experience. But since they took the most potent drive in the neshama, the drive to connect to meaning, and they shechted that drive and they left in the neshama an empty space, so now, you hear what's happening? The engine in the neshama that wants to connect to meaning, the engine's throbbing, but the piece is missing. You hear this? So what happens is you have an intense drive to nothing. It's embarrassing, it's crazy when a person thinks of how they function, and nothing could be more embarrassing. And yet that's what it is. People have the most intense pleasure. They spend a lot of money, they get all dressed up, to go and sit someplace around a table where the food is mediocre, right? To do what? Next time you're in such a situation, if you ever have to be, chas v'shalom, then I suggest what you do is just make a mental note of the train of events that the conversation ranges through. And if you want to really lose a friend, just say back to them after the hour you spent together what they talked about, how the dachshund died, and then how, you know, what you range through a series of, you follow me, you go through, you can't even remember the connection between them. Why did you go out of such a conversation? If you watch men sitting together who have an interest in sport, for example, you'll hear the most intense discussion. From a distance, you'll think these people are discussing the future of the world. When you get closer, instead of talking about in 1953, who scored this and that and this and that against whom, I mean, as if that's got any significance. But the truth is, it's intensely pleasurable. Intensely pleasurable. Right? The reason is this. There are stories about a great Rebbe, great Rebbe from the previous generation, when he used to go to the mikveh on Friday, he used to speak nonsense. You know, in a mikveh, in a bathhouse, or a bathroom, you're not allowed to speak words of Torah. You're not even allowed to think words of Torah. So therefore, since he wasn't allowed to speak Torah over there, so the Hasidim say, so then there's a tremendous urge to speak nonsense. So he walked around in the bath, in the mikveh, you follow, for the time that he had to be there, talking nonsense. You follow, just to get out this yetzer that he had for wasting time, isn't it? I heard from a very great and saintly individual that actually he wasn't doing that, because speech is too holy to do that with. Even in a place where you can't speak Torah, he was speaking chesed, asking people how they were, or finding out the news that he needed to know in the world. It had a function, even though it wasn't Torah. But to use speech, which is such a holy vessel, for things that are nonsense, even where it is allowed, even that he wouldn't do. But be that as it may. But if there are any questions on the subject immediately for the next few minutes, we'll try to think otherwise. It's a major thing. It's worth going over these ideas, because unfortunately, the punishment for Dvarim Batalim still applies, okay? Even though you will have a justification because it did feel good, but nevertheless, it's definitely forbidden. Definitely forbidden. The biggest problem with Dvarim Batalim is that usually in the course of such a conversation, much is said that's forbidden. Much is said that's forbidden. If you only discuss how the various dogs in the family died over the years, then it would be okay. But usually it doesn't stop at that. You end up speaking about people. and then you get into things that are not Dvarim B'Talim, but much worse than that. And that's what it is. It says that there's a special Gehenna. I'm sorry to have to frighten you. But it says that in the next world, the world of retribution, there's a special punishment for Dvarim B'Talim. That means there's a special torture that the Neshama goes through for things that it did wrong. There's a special form of torture for when you wasted time. And it's called Kafakela. Kafakela means, I don't know how to translate it, literally it means the cup of the slingshot. You know what I mean? The pocket of the slingshot. It's that part of the slingshot that he slung. You follow that? Why? Because the mystics say it's the experience of being slung or flung from one place to another, and as you're just about to arrive there, you're flung to another place. In other words, it's the emotion, you follow? The Neshama experiences the emotion of being projected towards purpose, but before it ever achieves the tangible element of the purpose, it's flung again. Why is that? Because that's what the crime was. The crime was that you use this incredible human energy, which is your life, but instead of taking it someplace, right, and using that time, which will never come again, so you use it just to, you know, blast out energy into the world and actually not produce anything with energy. So the experience when the Neshama is exposed to its own being, then that's what it is. Therefore, it's not advisable. One shouldn't do that. One should try and make sure that the words you speak, even if you're with people you have to be with who don't know about this, that you should at least try and make sure that the conversation revolves around things that are useful, at least kindliness, mitzvahs of chesed. You know, you've also got to be normal. I mean, if the next time you go out for coffee, next time you're shopping, you follow a weekday morning where you've got 2 hours, nothing to do. So you meet in the mall, wherever it is, with your friend, you sit down and have a coffee, and your friend starts to tell you the normal thing, and you know, say nothing for about half an hour. And when your friend asks you if you're feeling okay, you start explaining that, you know, this is a Dvarim B'Talim, Kafakela, you're going to be tortured in the next world. Your friend is subtly going to recede into the distance, you know. You're not going to see that friend again. But, you know, you've got to be normal. You should explain these things gently, you know, at the right opportunity. You know. Yes, please. Yes, clairvoyance is not what we're talking about. There is such a thing as clairvoyance in the world. And we've tried to discuss before that there are certain sensitivities that a person could have to certain energies that are actually correct and valid. Astrological, some people are sensitive to astrological forces, and others are sensitive to many other forces in the world. It's got nothing to do with prophecy. There are such things. They're valid. Again, you have to make the point that most people who are doing this around are not valid. They're just a coarse trick to take money or influence people. Then, as I said before, there are those who are sincere about it, but actually they're wrong. They think they're doing this thing, but they're not. They're just sensitive. They're just, you know, and then there are those who really know what they're doing, and they are doing it. And there is such a thing, definitely, there's no question. It's forbidden from a Jewish point of view, as I've said, in most of its applications, but it's got nothing to do with prophecy. You can be sensitive to certain energies. But prophecy means when Hashem speaks to you, and when miracles are manifest. That connection. Yeah, one more question? There was? No? Okay.